Det är torsdagen den 16 juni och du lyssnar på Ledarredaktionen, en podd från Svenska Dagbladet. Jag heter Paulina Neuding. Han är en av samtidens mest intressanta uttolkare, om ni frågar mig. Den bästsäljande konservative brittiske författaren Douglas Murray, till vardags redaktör på tidskriften The Spectator. Hans senaste böcker är The Strange Death of Europe och The Madness of Crowds. Och hans nya bok, The War on the West, bidrar med ytterligare ett perspektiv på samtidens ideologiska trender och märkligheter. Douglas Murray, it's great to have you at Ledarredaktionen.
It's a pleasure to be with you.
Douglas, what is an anti-racist baby?
Anti-racist baby is a children's book based on a not much more grown-up book by an American writer called Ibram X. Kendi called How to Be an Anti-Racist. And How to Be an Anti-Racist, as I say, which is the, as it were, adult version of the book, it basically divides the world into racists and anti-racists. And essentially, to be a racist is to disagree with the author of that book, Ibram X. Kendi. And to be an anti-racist is to agree with him. So an anti-racist baby is a baby that is in total agreement with Ibram X. Kendi. And a racist baby would be one that disagreed with Ibram X. Kendi. Of course, there's a problem here, isn't there? Which is, what the hell do babies know? Mm-hmm. But that aside, the point of this is an attempt to inculcate in the youngest possible people a particular doctrine of views, which is, as I say, that the world can be divided into goodies and baddies, racists and anti-racists, that babies, if they're white, are likely to be racist unless taught otherwise.
And but this goes only for white babies, right?
Only for white babies, yes. Mm. No black children or other groups can ever be racist. It's only white babies. And this follows, by the way, a certain amount of political claims, certain number of political claims in America in particular, that white babies can express racism from very early on, from a few months old and so on. This is all, of course, total nonsense. But it's very dangerous, I think. And one of the reasons why I actually write about anti-racist baby in the section racist babies in The War on the West is to highlight quite how dangerous and ugly a school of thought this is. It's profoundly divisive. It's extraordinarily offensive. And it's an attempt at a type of political indoctrination under the guise of something which Kendi and others know we care about, which is, you know, we in the West don't like being called racist. We recognize racism to be a very ugly thing and something that we deplore. That's not the same in every country, of course, or every society. Many societies don't care about being accused of racism, but they recognize that we in the West do. And so, as ever, racism is used as a tool to beat people with and make them agree.
Hmm. The reason I ask, of course, is your most recent book, The War on the West. What war are we talking about here and who is waging it?
There are lots of different types of anti-Westernism in the world. There's Chinese anti-Westernism, Arab anti-Westernism. The one I'm interested in, the one I principally write about in The War on the West, is Western anti-Westernism, the hatred of the West from within the West, by the West to the West, the stripping away of everything in our heritage, culture, history, the attacking of everything if it's ours, praise of everything so long as it's not. I'm referring to a virtual war, of course, and a cultural war, but one that does sometimes spill out with violent consequences, particularly in America. I think everyone is now downstream from American culture, and what happens in America spills out in all of our countries. You know, you get BLM protests in America and they spill out on the streets of Stockholm and London within days. And I stress, I mean, all of these things are connected, that within the West, we have got this remorseless assault on ourselves, by ourselves, attacking ourselves for the three cardinal sins of the modern era, which are racism, colonialism, and slavery. And we beat ourselves up and everyone in our past up about these things, completely ignoring the fact that all of these things are things that not only happened in history in every society, but happen in many societies around the world today. But this narrow lens through which everything in the Western past is now looked and judged has become a most extraordinary assault, an assault on everything that we've inherited in the West.
Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds, and they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
So there's an assault on our culture, our way of life, but also on whiteness itself, right?
Yes. Well, yes, because if you decide that you have to attack everything in the West, you also have to attack the people in the West. If you decided for some weird racist reason that you wanted to attack everything to do with Africa, it would involve at some point attacking black African people. If you decided to assault everything about China, at some point you'd have to attack the Chinese people. I mean, it's a very ugly, it'd be a horrible thing to do. But that would be what would be involved. Similarly, if you attack the West, you end up having to attack the people who make up the majority in the West, which is white people. And white people in the West in recent years have become the only group about whom you can be extraordinarily racist. There is residual racism in our societies, no doubt. But the only one that is socially acceptable, indeed gets people praise, is attacking people, denigrating them, generalizing about them based on their skin color if they happen to be white. That's why we get these pathologizing terms like white fragility, white guilt, white tears, white rage, and many
more. White women's tears.
White women's tears. Mm. Yes. A woman crying if she's white is particularly to be lampooned. In a way that, again, I mean, it would be totally socially unacceptable and quite right to talk about black tears and laugh at a black woman's tears and say that right. is using her tears. I mean, it would be a horrible thing to do. Hmm. I just seem to be one of a small number of people who tries to be consistent about this and say we should be consistent, and that includes not generalizing and being racist about people because they happen to be white.
Hmm. And as you said, this trickles down from these radical American institutions at universities to all the way down to, you know, Swedish Twitter. We had a leader of one of the Swedish parties, the Center Party, Annie Lööf, who thinks of herself as a liberal. She was complaining about these white men who were criticizing her on Twitter. And she had to take it back and made up an excuse that was very, very far-fetched. But she seemed to think that it was okay to criticize someone for being white.
Yes, of course. Well, it is. She's completely right. I mean, it is completely fine. Mm. I'm surprised she had to take it down, but it is deemed perfectly fine. I mean, remember, the most appalling thing to be is a dead white male.
Right.
If you dismissed whole branches of literature and thought because it was a product of dead black males, you would be identified as a racist. Dead white men is the most common pejorative term of our time, particularly in academia. That's just the product of dead white men, as if they had the triple insult of not only daring to be white and daring to be male, but daring to die as well, as if only a loser could be bad. Anyone at any point can pull out the card that they're being attacked by, for instance, white men. If that politician had said, I'm being attacked by all these brown men, all these black men, people would say, oh, that sounds ugly. Have you got any proof for that? Why do you single out their skin color? But yes, and it's all part of this thing I partly wrote about in my last book, In the Madness of Crowds. It's partly to do with this thing of the victimhood hierarchy, and that you have to prove that you are suffering in the hierarchy of how much can you prove other people have privilege? How can you prove that you don't have privilege? White men apparently have all the privilege according to this hierarchy of values, and therefore that it's possible to insult and assault them because you're punching up. That's the mistaken belief. And of course, as with any generalizations according to group, it's not only inaccurate but also ugly. How do you know what somebody's life experience is just by the color of their skin? How do you know what their life experience is just by their chromosomes? You don't.
You mentioned some real world consequences of this kind of thinking. You mentioned COVID vaccines, the proposed guidelines in the US. Can you tell us about that?
Well, yes. I mean, in the case of what I describe as the anti-whiteness, for instance, this is something that is now, you know, there was a time when people thought, well, that'll just stay in the sort of humanities or something. And actually, it spilt out in no time to what in America is called STEM subjects, the sciences, maths, engineering, much. And it's also spilt out into the medical realm, where there have been, amazingly, and I give chapter and verse on them in The War in the West, amazingly, there have been efforts to equalize perceived injustices by prioritizing certain patients at hospitals by dint of their skin color. Now, again, if you were to say that in Boston in the 21st century, a hospital or a medical authority would mandate that white people should be given priority over black patients, white patients should be given priority over black patients, you say, well, wow, that's a sort of apartheid system. Hmm. Well, what we see is that happening the other way around. And as I say, I give chapter and verse of people who are prioritizing patients if they are black. To think that in the 21st century you would have medical agencies and others who would judge people's fitness for medical attention based not on their needs but on their racial origins is It's quite astonishing. And yet it happens in this era this way round. And that is something, as I say, which I think a lot of people will find very shocking. But it's part of a much bigger story, this way in which everything that is perceived to be something that belongs to the West, that is, including the skin color that is the majority skin color in the West, is just ripe for assault.
What happens to a culture where you see everything about yourself as bad? Western canon, Western culture, Western music, religion, history, even gardening. Gardening is racist, apparently.
Yes, the chapter on racist gardening is one of my favorites because it's so ludicrous. And I think a lot of people won't believe it until they see it and read it or hear it. I think there's two answers to that very important question. One is there are some people for whom it's an elite luxury opinion, what I'm describing. They signal their enormous superiority to everybody else by engaging in the game that I'm describing. Hmm. By denigrating everything in the West, by presenting themselves as amazingly international and much more. So there are some people who do that as a luxury opinion, effectively.
That's a great term, by the way, luxury opinions.
Yeah, it's but there are lots of other people, of course, whom that luxury does not exist. For instance, people who do not have the socioeconomic benefits that some elites do, who can't just travel everywhere and anywhere, who have a place that's their home and they'd like to feel well about, and who the result of this self-denigration is profoundly destabilizing and destructive. I think what's more, people brought up to believe that they are guilty by dint of their birth, by their skin color, by their racial origin or ethnic origin or national origin, are very unlikely to achieve anything in their lives because they are being told that they bear a guilt which they can never atone for. And I reject this completely. I think that this is an outrageous opinion, and I think it would be outrageous if people did it to anyone of any skin color. And I think it's outrageous that they're doing it at the moment to white children, to say that, you know, children are born in Western societies in the 21st century have some kind of inherited guilt. No. It would be a very strange thing to go to Nigeria and say, because your ancestors engaged in the slave trade so eagerly and stole so many of your brothers and sisters in Africa for centuries, that you must be deemed in Nigeria today to be born into guilt, a black guilt at that. I mean, you would say, what a horrible thing to do. Well, yes, and it's horrible when it's done to white people as well. I think the aim of it is profoundly destructive, and its consequences are profoundly destructive. You are inviting young people to live lives where the best thing they could achieve would be to do no harm, no further harm, no additional harm, having already done the terrible harm of having been born. I think this is extraordinarily nihilistic, dangerous stuff to be embedding in the new generation.
When and where are children being told all these things?
Well, again, I mean, it spills out from America, but it's absolutely everywhere in the culture now. And again, I give chapter and verse. It differs from country to country, of course. You'll know much better than me what the situation is in Sweden these days with regards to this. But it seems to me that Sweden is consistent with other Western societies in having all of these mental viruses and more. But it's taught in America from schools upwards. So-called critical race theory is taught. It's part of the curriculum in state after state.
So it's not a myth that critical race theory is taught.
It's not a myth at all. And I give again chapter and verse. And anyone who doubts that can see the citations. It's also taught in the popular culture. It's taught through the media. I give an example of a program last year, one of the main evening shows in America, where a new census came out in America and showed for the first time in history the white population had declined. And when the host announced this, the audience burst into cheers.
But something similar happened in the UK, right? When the demographics in London were announced.
Yes, that's right. The new census figures that have come out, I think, will alarm a lot of people because they'll show a very swift demographic change, or an ever swiftening demographic change. The last census from 10 years ago, the new one is due, but the last census from 10 years ago, you know, when it said that white Londoners were now a minority in their capital city, it was presented as if this was only a good thing, something to be applauded. And that, again, I mean, it's an oddity which people have to recognize is odd. It would be very strange if people encouraged, again, I don't know, Africans, Nigerians to become a minority in their capital city. And when they did become a minority, to cheer it. It would be a very odd thing to do. It's only in the West that that's perceived to be normal today.
We have a situation in Sweden with something that's called humiliation robberies, where youths are being attacked by gangs and robbed and also humiliated for no apparent reason. It's just something that's being done to them. They're burnt with cigarettes, etc. And there was a report issued on this from a government agency, which concluded that usually these gangs consist of immigrants, first or second generation immigrants, and the victims are usually Swedes. And there are the occasional ethnic slurs. These victims are called Svenne, which is a derogatory term, which is derived from the name Sven. So a Swede, a damn Swede. And there was not really any interest in finding out whether racism had anything to do with it. We know that these humiliation robberies occur. We know that they're increasingly common. It's something that Swedish boys especially take into account when moving about in the public space. Why isn't anyone interested in finding out what's it about?
Because in all of our societies in the West, we've decided that we understand all problems, and the narrative cannot shift. And the narrative is that we are racist societies, and we're racist because, for instance, we don't allow everyone in the world who wants to come to our societies to come in. And as a result, we must pay in some way. And we know, because, again, we can turn it around and say, if there were gangs of white Swedes doing this.
Right, exactly.
Black Swedes. We would be all over this. The media would be all over it. They would use it as a lens, not just to explain itself, but also to understand everything about Swedish society. They would say that we are all guilty. They would say we all must bear a burden, that we are bringing up our young men wrong, and that women and men must make the men better, and that we aren't, and they're terrible. We would extrapolate so much out from it. Well, in the case of situations that you describe, the problem is everyone knows what the problem is, but they don't want to draw any conclusions from it because they've already decided what the conclusions can't be. It's a particular form of Western disease in the 21st century that there are problems we can't solve because we know what the problem can't be. And the problem can't be that it's black immigrant youth, for instance. It can't be, because what would you do about them? What would you do? I mean, among other things, there would be a political price to pay for all politicians who'd said that it was easy to bring such people in to integrate them. I mean, the people who said that would pay and who had advocated that would pay some kind of political price. They would be made to, as much as it would be if it was the other way around, that there were white politicians who claimed that there was nothing that any white people did that was wrong, and then it turned out that there were some people who were abusing black Swedes. You know, there would be a political price to pay. Well, what is the political price here? Nothing. No one knows what to do. So you can't have the problem. So everyone can see the problem, but you can't identify it or draw any conclusions from it. By the way, all of this, I should stress, is a total cul-de-sac, and people have to get out of it now. And I'm very happy to lead the way on some of this, and I have tried to by saying, among other things, for instance, no, I'm not guilty. I'm not guilty of anything by dint of my skin color or birth. I'm not guilty for anything that anyone before me has done, and neither are you. So Swedes born in the 21st century are not guilty of anything just by being born in Sweden. They're not guilty. You don't have inherited guilt. You're not bad because you're white. You're not bad because you're male any more than you're bad if you're female. You're not a racist from birth. You don't deserve to be talked to like that. You don't deserve to have your politicians and others speaking to you in that tone of voice. You've got to make them stop now.
I'd say, if anything, we're one of very few cultures in history who have tried to become multicultural.
Yes.
It's very uncommon. And it's come at a cost to our society.
For sure.
And to think that we had riots in Sweden, Black Lives Matter riots, violent riots.
Yes, that's one of the things I mentioned in Strange Death of Europe, two books back. It's so strange and interesting to me that Westerners are guilty, alleged to be guilty of the same crimes, whether they historically committed them or not. Sweden had no meaningful empire. Britain did. But why should British and Swedish people be deemed to be effectively equally guilty of colonialism? Again, I mean, everyone is accused of guilt of slavery in countries that abolished it and in the early 19th century and ones who abolished it later in the 19th century. There seems to be no distinction between the two things. We're all held equally responsible. It's as insane as claiming that everybody on the earth, face of the earth who's black is responsible for anything that everyone in history did whilst being black, or that everyone in modern day China should be held responsible for everything that any Chinese looking person did in history. It's an insane outlook. And we've fallen for it. We've been pushed into it. We've been bullied into it, and prodded into it, and kicked into it. And it's high time that people stopped.
But part of it has to do, obviously, with our ignorance about our own history and about the history of other cultures.
Yes.
So, for instance,
that's the truth. Yes.
So, if we talk about slavery, Britain decided to abolish slavery in 1807, right?
Yeah. King George III signed the Anti-Slavery Act. Yeah.
And then Britain began to fight slavery actively on the seas.
Yes.
And could you tell us about that? Because I'm not sure our listeners, or I should say I wasn't entirely aware of this before I read your book.
Yes. The British Navy, after the Anti-Slavery Act was put into law, the British Navy patrolled the high seas for decades at enormous cost of blood, lives, and treasure in order to stamp out slavery everywhere. So the British view, once Britain abolished slavery, was not just that we should stop it within the empire, but we should stamp it out as a global trade. And this has been estimated by some historians to have cost Britain more than Britain gained in the slave trade. You know, we've got also to remember that there are countries like Brazil that continued slaving into the 1880s. In the Arab world, slavery continued. In parts of Africa and the Far East and Middle East, slavery continues to this day. And there are estimated to be 40 million slaves in the world today, which is more than there were in the 19th century. And one of my contentions is that those people are paying a price of our Western indulgence in obsessing about very small parts, just little bits of the story of our own past, little bits of the story of the global past. We actually ignore a lot of modern day evils whilst obsessing about this. I don't think that one in a million Americans knows anything about anything other than the transatlantic slave trade. And you might say, well, nor should they, because this was something that their country was involved in. You think, well, it would be useful to at least have some context to know, for instance, that when America was founded, everyone was engaged in slavery. Everyone. That it was a sad commonplace of human history and all civilizations. It would be useful to have the context, but if you strip the context away, you can persuade young Americans, for instance, that their ancestors slaved, that they should be held guilty today for this, should pay some kind of reparations for this, and you strip away from them the simple fact that, sadly, this was an evil that everyone was involved in. That's useful context, but nobody's given the context. They're given everything wildly out of context, so that, for instance, figures like Thomas Jefferson and George Washington, founding fathers of America, are accused of because of their slave owning, and the context of the time is almost completely ignored, which is the context being that this was commonplace. Still horrible, but commonplace.
A lot can happen in the next 3 years. Like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans are available for these changing times. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer budget-friendly, flexible coverage for people who are in between jobs or missed open enrollment. The plans last nearly 3 years in some states, with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. So for whatever tomorrow brings, UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans may be for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
Yes.
Speaking of Thomas Jefferson and George Washington, statues. You were in Portland in 2020, right? During the riots. And you even, you went out with the rioters, you dressed like them.
Yes.
And you saw everything firsthand. What was that like?
Deeply disturbing to see people in a nihilistic void of their own creation. Going through the streets, intimidating citizens, assaulting police, and destroying their city. I mean, it was a close-up view of that thing that many of us have said, which is the profound ease with which people can destroy things, and indeed the glee with which they can destroy things, because it's so easy to destroy and so hard to build. Very easy to pull down a statue of Abraham Lincoln, like the mob did in Portland on the night I arrived there. Very easy to tear down a statue of Abraham Lincoln. Very hard to be Abraham Lincoln, to come from absolutely nothing and rise to the position of president, to hold the United States together whilst defeating the evil of slavery. Very hard to be Abraham Lincoln. Awfully easy to pull him down 200 years later. But watching these people, of course, these were people engaged in a nihilistic void and high on the octane of destruction. And obviously this gives their lives meaning for a time. I think they'll run out of that meaning quite fast, because there's nothing left to destroy in their town, among other things.
And Portland was once a quite civilized town, right?
It was a beautiful city at one time. Same thing with Seattle. A lot of these, mainly it has to be said, Democrat-run cities, a lot of these places were very beautiful, even in my own lifetime, my own memory. and they've been turned into slums with all of their history erased and destroyed and everything graffitied over and pulled down. And as ever with nihilists, it's, you know, the question is, what do you think you'll do next? What do you think you'll replace this with? What happens after you've destroyed everything? And the answer really, as far as one can see, is justice will come. Very unclear how that comes about or who does it or who judges it or who creates it. Of course, they won't, as the French revolutionaries and many other people discovered. After the destruction, all you get is the terror.
They can't build anything.
No.
It's only about the destruction.
No, I mean, ask these people even to mold and cast an iron statue. They wouldn't know where to start. But they can pull one down very easily, very easily. Ask them to do anything, build a house. They can't even build a tent, these people. And I've seen that again firsthand. They don't even know how to do that.
There's also the fact that everything changes so fast in this ideology, right? What was called a sex change 10 years ago, that's deeply bigoted today. You can't talk of sex change. It's sex something else.
You remember cross-dressers?
Yes, that was funny 10 years ago.
One feels almost nostalgic for them now.
Yeah, so everything has to change very, very fast because you're constantly looking for sinners. So you can't build anything.
It could be anybody.
Yeah.
The last week it was gay white men again.
Right. You wrote on Twitter that you don't celebrate Pride.
No, of course not. It's a ridiculous festival. Started as a march. It started with some justification many decades ago. Well, gay rights started with justification. Gay rights have basically been achieved some years ago in most of our societies. And I see no reason after the point of victory to have not just a march, but a week and now a month in which a quasi-religious festival is celebrated. I think it's grotesque. And a lot of other gay people think so. I have no interest in being force-fed diversity by corporations who are doing bad things and hope to cover them over by putting a bloody rainbow flag on their building. Or pathetic politicians like those in Sweden who bang on and on about Pride and then put a hijab on whilst they go to see the mullahs in Tehran.
Well, there are parts of Sweden where it would be very difficult to have a gay Pride parade.
Yes, but they hang gay people from cranes. And find me the Swedish politicians of the left who celebrate Pride, who do anything about it beyond their own borders. Because, of course, that would be colonialism, of course, remember.
Or rather, these are challenges that we can all easily solve after next election.
And don't forget, I mean, it's not a small thing. Look where the World Cup is being played.
Qatar.
In Qatar, where, again, homosexuality is illegal. I mean, this is an international sporting event. And sports, in particular, one of the things in our era which forever hector us about Pride and about BLM and all these teams still taking the knee for George Floyd two years on. I mean, are they ever going to stop? Apparently not. Oh, but also they'll go to Qatar, which runs a slavery system today. And I bet you anything they'll shut up about that. Of course they will, these damn hypocrites.
Let's talk about George Floyd, because you write about a similar case.
A case of Tony Timper. The case of George Floyd is very important because it was very clear in 2020 that this was the movement that was this was the event that was being used to justify a massive change of tone in America and the wider West. And what I mean by that is it was immediately clear that the death of George Floyd was to be seen as the lens through which to understand not just that particular appalling event, but to understand policing in America and then race relations across the West. Flat out false. It's a disgraceful lens through which to look at that. The death of George Floyd was appalling, and the policeman who was found guilty of it and seen on the video was, of course, tried and convicted and sentenced to life in prison. Did he represent all policemen? No. Did he represent all policemen even in the Minnesota area? No. Does he represent everyone in the West in some way? Absolutely not. And one of the things that's appalling about the weaponization of the death of George Floyd is, as I say, in the war in the West, the fact that this appalling incident was played in a very similar light a few years earlier in Texas, where five policemen killed a man in very similar circumstances, the knee to the neck and so on, a man who's profoundly mentally unwell and was seeking their help, and they killed him. And there is almost no attention on that case. A local newspaper pursued the case and got the police body cam footage 5 years later. But there was no interest in it or outrage, and the man's family have not been befriended by the President of the United States or anyone else, because Tony Temple was white, and there isn't any interest in that. But it's one of the reasons I say, and this, some people will find this hard to swallow, but they should look at the facts. The killing of George Floyd, there's not even any evidence that it was a racist killing. If there was evidence of any such thing, it would have been brought out at the trial by the prosecution, but it wasn't. There was no evidence that Derek Chauvin, appalling a man as he clearly is, was a racist. You might say, well, he was extraordinarily lax with the life of George Floyd, and you'd be right, but the arresting officers in Texas were lax with the life of Tony Temple. And by the way, nothing happened to them. One of them retired early. The other four are still serving as policemen in Texas. So we've got to be extremely careful about the narratives that are being forced upon us, the interpretations that are being forced upon us in the West at the moment. It's a very dangerous time where, for instance, again, you know, our sports teams are still being told you've got to take the knee to protest racism because George Floyd, and they are being persuaded that this is normal.
Hmm. The Swedish women's soccer team still takes the knee for George Floyd.
What do they think they're doing? Will they ever stop?
So what you're saying is it was an appalling murder, but we're not sure it's racist, and we're definitely wrong to think that it's something that signifies tells us what America is or what Western society is.
Let alone what Sweden is or what Britain is. It doesn't tell us anything about America particularly, and other than a policing issue that needs to be addressed seriously. But it doesn't tell us anything about relations between the races in Sweden in the 21st century. And again, I mean, it's, you know, football matches sometimes have 2 minute silences for, you know, soldiers killed in action, or, you know, for Veterans Day and things like that. They don't do it for years every day. Why do they do it with George Floyd? Because the most important story of our day is to claim that everyone is racist, that we're racist, and that this is evidence of our racism. And the fact that they have to point to one killing in Minnesota in 2020 as their evidence should suggest that they've not got very much evidence for the claims they make about the West. Mm.
But we only do this to ourselves. We don't do it with China.
No, it would be a very weird thing to do to China.
Greta Thunberg has not screamed, "How dare you," at China.
No.
And I'm thinking, maybe,
nor will she.
Maybe that is actual racism. Maybe people, these people don't think of the Chinese as ethical human beings with the same ethical obligations. Maybe there's an actual element of racism here. What do you think?
Yes, I think there is. I think there is. I think it's the presumption that there should be two different standards in the world. And we have one and the rest of the world has another. And if we embedded ours anywhere else, it would be colonialism. So we shouldn't do it. Mm. And of course, China, as I give examples, China is very happy with that arrangement, because it means that whilst we in the West are beating ourselves up over historic sins, they can get away with running concentration camps today.
Right. And they're also buying up Africa.
Yeah, buying up Africa, using Africans as big. It's not quite slavery, but it's not very far off.
And I don't think they're teaching their babies to be anti-racist.
They're definitely not doing that. They're definitely not doing that. Mm. Nor is any other society. It's a Western anti-Westernism. It's a Western obsession with our own guilt. And it's a monstrous thing. And it's so destructive. And as I say, one of the key things that people have to bear in mind is that it's wildly destructive of young people's prospects today. That a young man in particular, a young woman too, a young man in particular, born and brought up in the West, brought up on this stuff, is likely to be highly, highly demoralized throughout their life and very unlikely to achieve anything great.
The only thing you can do is deconstruct and destruct.
Yes. And I would like us to stop this period. I would like us to end it and to begin an era of construction again.
Let's talk about construction, because you actually try to pin down what's good about the West and about the Western heritage.
Yes. Yes.
That's very dangerous territory, isn't it?
I think it's very fertile and important territory. To say, well, we know it. We know there must be something good about ourselves. Why do we know that? Well, among other things, because the world wants to move here. When the boats go across the Mediterranean from the north shores of the of Africa and from the western shores of the Middle East, they do not meet boats going the other way. They don't meet French people hoping to make it to sub-Saharan Africa. When the migrants cross the southern border of the United States to get into America, they do not meet millions of Texans trying to flee to Venezuela. So, you know, there is no meaningful exodus of Swedes looking for safe harbor in communist China. Why? Why? Because we must have done something right. There must be something good about us. And the footfall proves it. The direction of travel proves it. We know it. We can see it. So the fact that that is the case today should tell us something. And I have a further contention. If that's the case today, it's because we must have done something good in the past. We haven't just landed here accidentally. Our societies are what they are because of what our predecessors did in the past. Because these societies were created this way, and they were created well by remarkable men and women who made good choices, not always perfect by any means, but made better choices than people did in other places. And that's why you have the rights you do, and I have the rights I do, and most people in the world want to be a part of that more than any other societies. They want to come to the West.
So the footfall proves what we've done right.
The footfall proves something incredibly important. And that conclusion alone, I don't even need to get onto all of the extraordinary scientific advancements, the cultural achievements, the cultural inheritances, the learning, the philosophy, the everything. I don't need to even get into that. I do. But the footfall alone should tell us something highly, highly suggestive. And that's why I say that the people who engage in self-loathing game must know something.
Douglas, you're right. Every school child knows about slavery. How many can describe, without irony, cringing, or caveat, the great gifts that the Western tradition has given to the world? How do we go about talking to school children about the gifts that the Western tradition has given the world?
You teach the rough with the smooth, or to put it the other way around, the smooth with the rough. You teach them how unusual it is. You give them some context, both historically and in the present day. Don't present to them that their job is to stand as judge, jury, and executioner over everyone in the past. One of the presumptions of our age is that because we know how the past went, we know how we would have acted, and we would have acted better than the people in the past. Because we know slavery is bad, if we had been alive in the era of slavery, we wouldn't have engaged in it. Flat out wrong, by the way. Most people do exactly what everyone else in their age does. And if you lived in an age of slavery, the high likelihood is that you would have engaged in it as well, if you could have done, if you had the chance. So bear that in mind and have some humility. Assume that you're doing something in this age, several things most likely, maybe loads of things, that our successors will look at with bewilderment and try to work out what they are and stop doing them. But have a bit of humility about the past and That, of course, among other things, is a preemptive request to the future to be kind with us in turn.
So have some humility with the past. Douglas Murray, thank you so much for joining Ledarredaktionen and Svenska Dagbladet.
It's a great pleasure.
Och tack till er som lyssnade. Ni får som vanligt gärna höra av er till oss med frågor, tankar, idéer och kritik. Jag heter Paulina Neuding och producent idag var Jesper Sandström. Tack för att ni lyssnade.